This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast featuring weekly interviews with the most brilliant minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is always free of charge, and unlike the mainstream financial press, we are not a platform for market cheerleading. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the business telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Nathan Egger.
Welcome to Macro Voices, Episode 2, recorded February 17, 2016. I'm Eric Townsend. We have another fantastic show lined up for you with Dr. Mark Faber joining me later as today's special interview guest. I'll be talking to Dr. Faber about investing in Asia, U.S. monetary policy, Chinese credit growth, and much, much more.
And I'm Nathan Egger. We're going to dive right into this week's markets. Let's again lead with the equities, Eric, because clearly the theme this week is volatility. Eric, we're speaking here mid-session on Thursday. We haven't seen a lot of action today, but the S&P 500 has shown an impressive rally so far this week. Where are we headed from here?
Well, I think it's almost done. I think that what you're seeing is the S&P is actually rallying partly on short covering. There's a bit of a short squeeze in play, but mostly in sympathy with the oil market. And we'll talk about that in more detail when we get to oil. I don't think that the bump that we're seeing in oil is going to last. I think it's headed back down to the downside. I think equities are going to turn and follow oil down. But that doesn't happen until the oil market turns back to the downside a little bit more decisively than it did this afternoon on Thursday.
All right, let's go ahead and cover crude oil next. The buzz right now is that a deal has been made around a production freeze. Does this mean anything? And if so, what does it mean? What's coming next for us in the oil market?
Well, it means a whole lot in terms of perceptions. I don't think it means anything in terms of a change in fundamentals, but it definitely has affected the market quite dramatically. This occurred literally minutes after we went to press with last week's episode of Macro Voices. And what happened was the UAE's oil minister reiterated that OPEC was ready to talk about production cuts. And eventually they brokered a couple of meetings, one over the weekend and another one on Tuesday. And I think that what was going on here is previously you had Russia trying to jawbone the market, as we talked about on last week's program. That was going on. Saudi Arabia was initially denying things when Russia was making statements about discussions with OPEC, because Saudi Arabia was able to deny that. When the Russians started saying we're going to meet with Venezuela and we're going to meet with other OPEC producers, Saudi Arabia was not in a position to deny anything. And I think Saudis got involved in the discussion in part because they wanted to have the control of being able to deny things when they want to deny things, but also to send a message, which is that they are still ready to discuss the possibility of a production cut. Now, as we talked about on the program last week, Nathan, I don't think that a production cut is possible. I don't think it is technically possible for Russia to implement a production cut. I don't think that even the agreement that was made Tuesday, supposedly, around a production freeze was contingent only on if Iran and other countries were to participate in it. Iran, of course, said today very clearly there's no way they can participate in that. They need to ramp their production up to pre-sanctioned levels, and they said they would never consider participating in anything like this unless it had some loophole or provision that allowed them to first get back to where they feel they should be at pre-sanctions production levels. None of these things are going to happen, but what has happened is we have the symbolic message from Saudi Arabia saying that they're willing to come to the negotiating table and at least have a conversation about these things. I think that the market has gone pretty much crazy on speculation and hype and sentiment. I don't think it's going to lead anywhere. I think that we're going to soon realize that the oversupply is still an oversupply, that we are running out of storage capacity. We're already at operational capacity of about 80% of total capacity in Cushing, Oklahoma. So this is a very problematic situation, and I don't think that this buzz about a production cut is headed anywhere, but it definitely has taken the market up to above its channel resistance line. So we're teetering with a breakout that could accelerate a short squeeze further if another rumor were to take us even further to the upside. But I'm hoping that common sense is going to kick in and people are going to realize that you really can't have a production cut with the current political backdrop that exists between OPEC members.
This is something that investors need to clearly understand about these headlines about a production freeze. A production freeze at record high January production levels is a long way off from a production cut. Two very different things. Now, on last week's show, both you and Jim Rogers expressed your doubts about gold having raced all the way up to more than $1,260 per ounce. You described the move as parabolic, and Mr. Rogers outright said it looked like a blow-off top. Since then, gold, we've seen it tumble back below 1,200. You guys seem to have called that one.
Well, I think it was very easy to call the parabolic move likely leading to some kind of retracement. It did tumble below $1,200. But as we're speaking late session on Thursday afternoon, we're looking at 1,231 again. So it's halfway back up to that 1,260 that it touched. The question is whether it can sustain this breakout. If we move back above 1,260 to new highs and the move continues, I think at some point you just have to throw the towel in and say, this move has legs to it. It's headed higher. But again, keep in mind the analogy to 2008. We had a move higher in gold. Then when everything started selling off aggressively, gold sold off with everything else. So I think you've got to be agile here. It does look like this breakout maybe has legs, but you've got to be careful and look for the possibility of a reversal, especially if the dollar strengthening rally continues.
All right, well, finally, let's move on to fixed income. We've been seeing Treasury yields falling across the board. How much further can they fall, Eric?
Well, I wouldn't be surprised if we eventually see a retest of the 1.36 low yield on the 10-year Treasury. I think that was back in 2012. We're not seeing anything close to that yet, but I think that the current equity sell-off is just getting started. I also think that it's entirely possible that this equity sell-off could turn into something pretty dramatic before eventually central bankers step to the rescue. If I'm correct about that, we could see a safety trade globally into U.S. Treasuries that could perpetuate the dollar rally, could potentially be negative for gold, negative for oil. We'll see what happens.
All right. Well, thank you for the market perspective, Eric. Now we're going to give our listeners what they're waiting for. Eric's interview with Dr. Mark Fauber is coming up right after this.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is the one and only Dr. Mark Fauber, editor of the Gloom, Boom, and Doom Report. Mark, you have been quite outspoken in your views about the American stock market since 2009. You said that if central banks print money out of thin air, it has to go someplace, and a lot of it would end up in asset markets, and you were absolutely correct about that. But you've also been quick to note that when central banks eventually take the punch bowl away, markets will plummet. But then you went on to say that even if that happens, at some point when things get really bad, central bankers are going to come back and print more money. So let's get an update on your view in where we stand in this story. You've clearly gotten this right so far. Are we at the point where central banks are running out of bullets or asset markets headed lower? And at some point, do you think they're going to come to the rescue with QE4 or some other negative interest rates or some other kind of stimulus?
Well, basically, thank you for the introduction, and I'm very happy to talk to you. I think that it's important to understand the government, the Treasury Department, and the Fed is one and the same. They can manipulate markets, and they've taken measures after December 2008 and kept interest rates artificially low for a very long period of time. And then last December 2015, they increased the Fed fund rate to 0.25%, probably precisely at the wrong time. But that aside, my view is that if the stock market drops by, say, 20% off the peak in May 2015, that's soon 1 year, by more than 20%, they'll take additional measures. Now, in many countries, we have already negative interest rates. The Fed can do the same. I'm not sure about the constitution, where it would be constitutional to introduce negative interest rates. But there's not many people care about the constitution anymore. So it's a possibility. The second possibility that is coming up now more and more by some economists is helicopter money. Helicopter money would be, instead of just launching QE4, to actually send each household, say, a check for $1,000 or a check for $10,000 or whatever it is. Now, I'm not sure, again, if Congress would agree to such a measure, because the Congress at the present time is, to a large extent, or the Senate is controlled by the Republicans, and whether they would agree to that measure is questionable. But it's a possibility. And what they also, I think, can do is essentially to abolish paper money. If you abolish paper money, you can introduce less than zero interest rates, and that would obviously hurt savers, but it may not boost consumption and the economy, because in countries like Sweden, Denmark, Finland, Switzerland, we already have negative interest rates, also Japan now, and it doesn't boost the economy because people feel insecure, they feel worried about it, their savings are no longer giving them any return. So the reaction in most countries has actually been that the savings rate goes up. And that is basically near-term negative for the economy. I think it would be good for the economy in the U.S. to have a higher saving rate in the long run, but near-term it has a negative impact. So my view is, yes, I think, you understand, the government and the Fed and the Treasury and also the academia at universities is essentially controlled to a large extent by neo-Keynesian interventionists. They think they are smarter than you and me, that they need to intervene into the economy, intervene into the free market. And we've seen what a disastrous result that had. It had the consequences of the Nasdaq bubble, then the housing bubble, and then the financial bubble in 2007, 2008, the subsequent greatest recession since the Great Depression in the 30s. So their interventions have largely failed, and I think that will continue to be the case. But you understand, people who are so arrogant and conceited as the academics at central banks and so forth, they will not shy away from increasing the dosage. In other words, like you give to a patient antibiotics and they are useless, they don't achieve the desired results, so you double up. And the doubling up will not help at all, but that's what the central banks, in my view, will do.
Well, you make an excellent point about helicopter money. It's something that I think a lot about. You know, the whole market just assumes that the Fed is going to be there to rescue the market. And I think politically it's very possible that the people will stand up, especially in an election year, and the next round of quantitative easing will be helicopter money, QE for the people, not for the bankers. And it won't bank.
Well, helicopter money is basically a combination of fiscal policies and monetary policies. Basically, if the Treasury sends a check or the Fed to every household of $1,000, say, it can boost economic activity for a month or two. You know, and then people can go out and drink more in a bar or spend more in McDonald's or restaurants, go on a holiday and so forth. But in my view, the impact on the U.S. economy will be very small, because if people buy goods, most of the goods are imported anyway. So it's not going to boost the U.S. economy much. And once you have launched helicopter money one, you may have soon to launch helicopter money two to sustain the spending. So all these measures, they are quick fixes. Like if you have a house and the cracks in the walls, you just put some paint on top of it. It looks nice for a little while, and then it gets worse and worse again.
Okay.
It's a typical helicopter money is a typical measure that occurs in botox economies. You just fix, but you don't improve it in the long run.
An act of desperation to cover over the symptoms. Let's move on now to Asia and emerging markets versus developed markets. Most Westerners are used to thinking of Asia as a place whose economies are almost entirely dependent on manufacturing exports to the West. Most Westerners continue to assume that Asia doesn't really have any middle class to speak of and that its economies are completely dependent on exports. Those are all old stereotypes, though. In your January gloom, boom, doom report, you had an excellent piece on the growing and advancing economies of Asia and South Korea in particular. So please give our listeners kind of a high-level perspective. What's going on in Asia in terms of high-level trends, and what will this mean for emerging markets investors in coming years?
Well, first of all, I think Westerners don't quite understand that in Asia, if you start Asia from the Middle East up to Far East Russia, and in the south from Australia, New Zealand, to the north, Mongolia, Kazakhstan, Russia, that there are roughly 4 billion people in Asia. So it's a much larger population than what we have in the Western world. China alone has 4 times as many people as the U.S. and the EU combined. And when I came to Asia in 1973, Asia was very poor. And even in the 1980s, I had a wealthy client from Chicago. He asked me in the early 80s, Mark, how is it that Asia is so poor? But that is no longer the case. We have some very rich countries measured by GDP per capita. The first one to really develop was Japan after the war until 1990, and then South Korea, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Singapore followed. And then after 1978, China began to open up, but it was a very slow process. But after 1990, it took off. And so when people talk about Asia, they don't realize the largest beer brand in the world is not Bud Light, but Snow. It's from China. And the second largest is Qingdao, also from China. Among the 10 largest beer brands, 4 are Chinese. There are 120 million Chinese that travel outside China every year, much more than Germans or U.S. traveling overseas. And they are not poor people. On a per capita basis, the Chinese in Thailand are the largest spender, according to the Tourist Authority of Thailand. So we have already a big middle class, and it's a myth to think that Asians don't consume. They consume a lot. They are the biggest internet users in the world, and. Anyway, the point is, China is now slowing down, and massively so, and maybe they have a financial crisis or already are in a financial crisis mode, which is unlikely to end well. But equally, there are areas in Asia, like Indochina, that still have a large potential. Indochina being defined as in the east Vietnam, northwest Laos, southwest Cambodia, Thailand, Myanmar, you know, what's the old Burma, India, Bangladesh, and in the north, Yunnan province of China, and in the south, Malaysia, Singapore. That region receives at the present time huge foreign investments, also for political reasons, because the Chinese are investing a lot of money in these countries. And so the Japanese, the South Korean, the Taiwanese, under American influence, are also doing it to counterbalance the Chinese influence. And so we have, although growth in Asia is at the present time practically non-existent, but in these countries there's still strong growth in terms of exports, industrial production, and per capita incomes.
I'd like to move on to a listener question that was posed in our listener discussion forums at macrovoices.com/forums. Diego in Mexico described his fascination reading your article about South Korea in the January Gloom Boom Doom report because he saw so many parallels between his own country of Mexico and South Korea going back to the 70s in terms of low GDP and a lot of the things that you described in that article. Diego can't help but wonder, though, what went wrong for his country, because it seems that Mexico has not had anywhere close to the success of South Korea, despite having started from some of the same fundamentals in terms of GDP per capita and so forth. So what did Mexico get wrong that South Korea got so right?
I think that's a very good question, and I think that we have to look to a large extent at the mentality of people. Arnold Toynbee, already the historians, pointed out that some people in cold climates, they are more thrifty and have a higher savings rate and have higher work ethics than people in warmer climates. And I believe that the Koreans, they did what the Chinese do today. When Japan was already quite rich in the 70s and very successful in terms of eroding the lead of U.S. car makers, Korea was nothing, Taiwan was nothing. But they copied the Japanese, they copied and the Taiwanese did the same, and the same happened in Singapore. And these are people who have a hard-working mentality. I mean, I don't want to sound racist, but how many semiconductor plants are they in Africa? I think a lot has to do with there is corruption in Asia, but less so probably than in other countries. And these countries like Korea, Taiwan, Singapore, Hong Kong, they didn't have any agriculture. So people either had to work or starve. There was no going back to the countryside and enjoying the fruits of the earth. Like, I live in Thailand. In Thailand, the curse is that there is an abundance of food. So people don't really have to work very hard if they don't feel like coming to their jobs in the morning or suddenly have a different view. They go home to the families in the countryside, and there they have enough to eat. They don't live in luxury, but they have enough to eat. And I think very few countries in the world will achieve the success of, say, the European countries in terms of having risen to relatively high wealth in the last 200 years through the Industrial Revolution. Very few countries will have achieved the success of the U.S. until the 1950s, 1960s. Since then, it hasn't been all that great. And so I believe really successful economies are more the exception than the rule. But I have sympathy for Mexico. I go to Mexico quite frequently. And I think, actually, that it has quite a good potential. But exactly why it hasn't been able to capitalize on its potential, I'm not so sure.
Let's move on to another high potential country, India. Most Westerners don't think much about India as an investment target, but I know that you not only invest in India yourself, but you also serve as the chairman of India Investment Fund. So India is clearly a market that has your attention. Please give our listeners the elevator pitch on India. Why would people care about investing in India? What's the case for India?
Well, basically, the case for India is that it has been cursed by socialism and policies of isolation until, say, 15, 20 years ago. And then it began to open up, but it still had a horrible bureaucracy and laws and regulations that are very unfavorable to growth. Now, it doesn't mean that some companies didn't grow a lot. We have 30 years ago, there was no IT industry in India, and today it's a center of the IT industry and of the outsourcing of software programs and so forth. So they've done relatively well despite of the government. To move really ahead, they need a strong man that can override the different factions and can reduce the bureaucracy meaningfully. Now we have Modi, he's the Prime Minister of India. He's a reformer, he'd like to do that. But it's very difficult for him to do it, you understand? In China, Xi Jinping, he can take any measure he likes. He has the power. But Modi doesn't have the same power in India. And so the potential for India is, of course, huge, because in about 10 years' time, India will have a larger population than China. And whereas, say, China consumes more than 10 million barrels a day of oil, India consumes less than 4 million. In other words, the GDP per capita is much lower in India. And the potential is there. Whether it will be able to capitalize on its potential, that is not entirely clear. But equally, I think, you know, someone who manages the fund in India, and that applies to all emerging markets, there will be a lot of consolidation. In other words, companies taking over smaller players. So I think a stock picker probably can do quite well in India and, by the way, throughout the emerging world.
Okay, let's move on to real estate next. Most Americans have either never heard of China Beach or they know it only as an old TV show about American soldiers that were stationed on some beach someplace in Asia. Let's fast forward to 2016. Bring our listeners up to date, Mark. Where is China Beach? What's going on there today? And why have some international real estate investors recently taken an interest in buying properties there?
Well, basically, when I was young, in the 50s and 60s, we went to Spain, and there were lots of resorts that just started. I mean, Torre de Molinos was very, very small village. Benidorm had a few hotels, and that's it. And these became eventually huge resort areas, huge developments for tourism took place and so forth. When we first went to Vietnam in 89, there was nothing at all. And we then built a hotel, and the hotel is still there, and it's successful. But because of some, not dispute, but some problems among the partners, we sold it then, I think in 95 or 96. And then we developed another hotel, the Nam Hai, a five-star hotel, which is very successful. But that whole coast, if you visualize Vietnam as a snake, in the north you have Hanoi, at the north, and in the south Ho Chi Minh, and on the coast facing China, in the middle you have Da Nang. North of Da Nang is Hue, the old capital, and south of Da Nang, about 30 kilometers or 30 miles from Da Nang, is Hoi An, is a UNESCO protected city. And that whole beach will become a huge thing. We have now a hotel, I think it's called the Crown Plaza, and it's it receives 15 charter flights of Chinese a week that go there gambling. The gaming money there, the gross gaming revenues monthly are $3 billion, just one casino. It's a lot of money for one casino. And the attraction of China Beach is it's relatively close to southern China. In other words, the whole of Guangdong province, Hong Kong, relatively close to Taiwan, relatively close to South Korea, because the Koreans, they like to go there for golf. And the Koreans, because of their climate, they don't mind that the coast is a little bit on the cool side in winter time. So there's lots of Koreans going there. And there are, I think, three flights every day from Japan into Da Nang. It's also becoming an industrial city. So that region is becoming very big, as well as, by the way, Cambodia. Cambodian exports late last year were up 20% year on year. Not many countries have exports that go up by 20% year on year. Certainly not the Japanese. And in the U.S. in December, exports were down 6% year on year. So it's a boom town. And Laos is still the Asia that existed, say, 40, 50 years ago, is also being developed. And Myanmar as well. So all these countries in this Indo-Chinese region, which I described before, are going to grow a lot. The problem for foreign investors, unless they go there themselves, Vietnam has a stock market. People can buy Vietnamese stocks, but there's no active stock market in Cambodia and in Laos and in Myanmar. So people have to invest through direct investments. And then there is a relatively high execution risk.
Okay. So definitely a sophisticated investor's market, but a lot of opportunity.
But like the early investors in America, the ones that really made money is the ones that went to America and lived in America. Foreign investors in America, they lost money in the 19th century in railroad bonds, in canal shares. They lost a ton of money.
So it sounds like Vietnamese beach real estate is a boots-on-the-ground investment for people who have the resources to be there and monitor their investment.
Yes, I think, you see, Asia is still early days. Say in Asia, very few people have second homes. There are some people in Hong Kong that have second homes, say in Phuket, in the south of Thailand, and some Chinese may have a second home in Hainan Island and so forth. But by and large, it's early days, also in India. And because of cheap flights nowadays, people can actually travel without incurring huge expenses. So tourism, in my view, is a high-growth area going forward.
Okay. We've talked a lot about the good news stories in Asia. I want to move on to some of the not-so-good news stories, specifically China and their predicament.
That's my specialty.
A lot of people are focused on the Shanghai Composite Index right now. In other words, they're looking at stock prices. But I think a lot of Western journalists fail to really understand the credit growth story in China. So I'd like to start with, the 2008 credit crisis in the United States was caused by too much debt, much of which was under-collateralized or unserviceable due to expiring teaser rates. Please contrast China's credit picture in 2007 with what it looks like today and explain what the implications could be for markets and investors going forward.
Well, basically, what happened after 2008, the recession in the U.S. officially ended June 2009, but already in December 2008, the Fed slashed interest rates from the Fed fund rate to zero, basically. And combined in China with very expansionary fiscal policies, in other words, as a percent of the economy, they had an even larger fiscal deficit than the U.S. and they also printed a lot of money, led to a colossal investment boom. And by the way, not just in China, but in other emerging economies. If you look at capital spending in emerging economies as a percent of the global economy between 2005 and 2014, it doubled. Now it's no longer growing and it's going to contract. But what happened is in China there was a huge credit bubble that financed this capacity expansion. And now, not only in China, but in other emerging economies as well, they have these huge overcapacities. And so when you think about it, what the Fed's policy did, the central banks and the Fed basically wanted to create inflation. First of all, it's very questionable whether to have inflation is good or bad. But let's not talk about this now because it takes a while to explain. So in the 19th century, the U.S. had deflation and strong economic growth. So it's wrong to say that deflation is bad and inflation is good. But basically, the Fed wanted to create inflation, but with these artificially low interest rates, they created a huge credit bubble in lower credits. In other words, practically every company could just borrow money because if I, as an investor, can't get any money on my deposits, I'm tempted to buy the bonds of a company that, say, has a yield of 6%. And so there was a huge growth in lower quality bonds, so-called junk bonds. And we had this huge credit bubble building up in China, where credit as a percent of the economy over the last 6 years went up by 50%. According to the Bank of International Settlement, no country in the age of capitalism has experienced this kind of credit growth in such a short period of time. So we have this credit bubble, and it will have to be deflated one way or the other. But you understand, we can have a crisis in China. If you look at the U.S. 1800 to today, we had in the 19th century already more than 15 economic and financial crises, the canal boom and bust, the railroad boom and bust, the California boom and bust, the Chicago boom and bust, and so forth. And then we had a civil war, and we had World War I, and then we had the Great Depression and World War II. But despite of all these things, the economy continued to grow in the long run. So I think that China has a problem at the present time and that it will be bad for a while, but that in the long run, China still has a good potential with one proviso. We need peace in the world, and that is not guaranteed.
Unfortunately, I couldn't agree with you more on that one. I'm curious, going back to China, Kyle Bass has been very outspoken about his decision to commit more than half of the $1 billion of assets that he has under management to a short play on the Chinese yuan. Basically, the bet is that China will have no choice but to continue to devalue dramatically from where they are already. Would you agree with that view? Do you think Mr. Bass is onto something, or do you think he's overreacting to the situation there?
Well, yes and no. Basically, the difference between some other countries that had to devalue significantly and China is that China is not less competitive. It is more competitive than before. The trade surplus in China is going up, not down. Now, they have a large capital flight. But in my view, if the Chinese really want, and maybe they have an agenda for having this large outflow of capital. Who knows? And some of it is direct foreign investments, like they bought a Swiss, or they're buying a Swiss agricultural company that is similar to Monsanto. They're paying over $30 billion. So some of the capital, outgoing capital, is actually not capital flight per se, but investing overseas. And number two, the Chinese are not totally stupid. They know what Kyle Bass' position is, and they also know what Soros' positions are. Every Chinese anywhere in the world is a potential spy for China. And so they're very well informed about everything that is happening. And the bets on a lower Chinese currency depends to a larger extent on U.S. dollar strength. Now, in my view, and I cannot say I know for sure, but say put yourself in the position of the Chinese. They see the Chinese, the one thing they don't want to do is to lose face. So when they see some hedge fund managers that could essentially make money from shorting their currency, they will do everything that these hedge funds don't make the money. That I can assure you. So what in my opinion happened is the people that were short the RMB or the yuan were also short the yen and the euro. And so the Chinese with their reserves, what is it for them to shift, say, 100 billion or even 500 billion out of U.S. dollars into euros and yen? So they pushed up the yen and the euro, and they weakened the U.S. dollar. And so some of the pressure on the yuan has gone away. Now, you understand, all central banks are manipulators. In a free market, manipulators, they go to jail. It's a crime. But central bankers is like some pigs are better than other pigs. And the central bankers, they can manipulate everything and they don't go to jail. So in my view, the Chinese still have some ammunition. I'm not sure it will be successful, but I can tell you that for China, there is zilk advantage to devalue. There's no need.
Okay. Let's move on to precious metals next, particularly gold. You had an excellent article in the January Gloom Boom Doom report from one of the NovaGold executives. They have a very bullish picture. I can't help but remember 2008, though, when gold initially popped, and then as everyone started to panic, gold sold off with everything else. And I look at the continuing strong dollar story and a lot of fundamentals that suggest to me that maybe gold is not done with its correction. What do you think? Is it time to buy gold here? Does it still have more downside? Are you putting faith in this breakout that we've seen in the last few weeks?
Well, you know, I kind of indicated before that we have this manipulation in markets. And I think it's very difficult to make any prediction because, like, if tomorrow the Fed announces QE4 and not just $85 billion a month, but say $200 billion a month or anything, you can move markets. So we don't know. But the one thing my sense tells me is that when you have negative interest rates, and now there are $8 billion worth of bonds, of sovereign bonds that trade at the negative yield. When you have that, the holding cost of gold is relatively low. Gold you can't print. There is some mining supply, and I agree with that. There's some central bank selling and some manipulation probably. But basically, you can't print it as easily as paper money. And in view of the fact that the academics, in their desperation, after having essentially largely failed to boost economic activity, that they may move to electronic money. In other words, you abolish banknotes. In view of that, I think that every investor should hold some precious metals. Now, someone may say, oh, I will only hold 5% of my assets in precious metals. And somebody will say, I want to have 50% of my money in precious metals. I tell everybody, my, say, simpleton asset allocation is roughly 25% real estate, 25% equities, 25% bonds and cash, and 25% precious metals.
Okay, and what about the question of precious metals versus mining stocks? It sounds like your view is because of the potential of some extreme risk, you really favor physical precious metals over the stocks, is that right?
Yes, but I've written about this. The mining stocks worldwide, as of, say, the third quarter of last year, became incredibly depressed. You know, you had American Barrick at $5.50. Now, the day before yesterday, it went to over 12. You know, there's sometimes when it's worthwhile to buy the miners because they're so incredibly depressed. Equally, there's sometimes when it's the time to sell the miners because they've been driven up by enthusiasm and excessive bullish sentiment. So I would say right now, if someone has a higher risk appetite and he wants to make money, the gold miners are probably more interesting. The bulk of my precious metal exposure is in physical gold, not miners. But I've bought some miners. Actually, I sold some the other day, but I may buy them back, or will buy them back.
Okay. Before we close, I want to take a moment to compliment you, Mark, on the Gloom, Boom, and Doom report. I've noticed
very
that
kind
a
of
lot
you.
Of, well, you know, it's you deserve it, and it's amazing. The newsletter guys, most of them are all telling the same story. One of them writes a good article about something, then all of the others are writing an article about the same subject. You're in a completely different category. Every issue is completely new content. It's always full of graphs and charts, and it's always interesting. So I
very
really
kind
want
to
compliment you on an original, thoughtful, and very interesting thing. So tell our listeners, please, where they can find out how to subscribe.
Well, the best is probably to go to the website, www.gloomboomdoom.com.
Okay, so once again, folks, you can learn more about Dr. Faber's excellent newsletter at www.gloomboomdoom.com. Nathan Egger and I will be back with more commentary as Macro Voices continues right after this.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Nathan Egger.
Helicopter money. That sounds like it could be kind of fun. We heard you and Dr. Faber here discussing how helicopter money, this idea of some combination of fiscal and monetary policy being aimed directly at spenders, directly at Main Street, rather than the forms of quantitative easing that we've seen in the past. Now, we saw Ray Dalio come out and echo Dr. Faber's sentiments today. He was talking about how another round of quantitative easing certainly will push asset prices somewhat higher, but investors and savers are still going to want to save, lenders are still going to be cautious, and borrowers are going to remain cautious as well. So what it's all going to amount to is quote-unquote pushing on a string. So any further monetary stimulus that we might see from central bankers probably going to be directed more at spenders rather than at investors, savers, and Wall Street.
And I think, Nathan, that this is probably the biggest macro risk, tail risk to equity investments that most market participants are just not paying attention to. And what I'm talking about is everybody assumes that the Fed put is still there, that if things really get bad, if the stock market starts to really crash the way it did in 2008, everybody assumes that the Fed is going to be there. The Fed's got our back. The Fed's going to bail us out with more stimulus money, and it's going to flow into asset markets like it did last time. I think it's very, very likely that parts of that story will play out. I think that the stock market's going to get really ugly. I think the Fed is going to want to come to the rescue and print more money. But I think that there will be a public outcry and a lot of political pressure from Congress and from the public to say, if you're going to print more money, it should be for the benefit of Main Street, not for Wall Street. And we might find that the support to asset markets that everybody equates with QE might not be there in the next round of QE.
Well, you know, if the central bankers are running out of bad ideas, of which they've had so many, they could always look to Twitter for inspiration. I saw a Twitter user today suggesting that maybe we could just fly helicopters and throw gift certificates out the window with a 30-day expiration.
Well, let's do our part then, Nathan, to help save the global economy. Listeners, starting right now for the next 30 minutes, you can get a free lifetime subscription to Macro Voices just by clicking on the subscribe button. And it was already free. Okay, I guess we can't do that one.
So no cash needed here. And we're starting to see headlines every day about this war on cash and why we don't really need it. And that combined with negative interest rates that we're starting to see around the globe are creating a feeling of insecurity. And this is actually having the opposite of its intended effect. And we're seeing increased savings rates around the globe, as Dr. Faber was talking about.
Well, I think it's really sad, too, that most people don't seem to understand the connection between negative interest rates and the war on cash. If you look at what's going on, you would assume, it would seem natural to assume anyway, that the government ought to be promoting the sound principles that you and I grew up with of saving and investing for the future, being conservative, being responsible. That's not the government agenda. What they want to do is they want to promote spending in the economy, even if it means reckless spending that is spending borrowed money. They want to stimulate the economy by getting consumers spending, and they're not really concerned about the long-term implications of what it means to savers and investors. So what they want to do is impose negative interest rates to intentionally penalize savers and investors for saving their money rather than spending it right here and now. So they want to literally undermine the good advice that you and I grew up with to save and invest for the future. The problem is that as they try to do that, if negative interest rates prevailed, so you had to pay money to keep your assets in a bank account, all the smart people who had a lot of money would take it all out of the banking system. They would withdraw all of it in cash and put it in a vault or a safe deposit box or a safe or something in order to keep it safe so they don't have to pay negative interest rates to let the bank store it for them. The only way the government can impose negative interest rates is if they literally take away your right as a citizen to take your wealth out of the banking system and store it in cash. If they make it illegal for you to hold cash, then you have to keep your assets in the banking system and they can get away with imposing negative interest rates. It is just ridiculous in terms of how what a fundamental human right of being able to take your own assets out of the banking system is being taken away, but nobody sees it that way because it's being sold to the public under this false pretense of a war on terror.
Right. And on top of that, we're hearing this narrative about how, yeah, eliminating cash is all about public safety and security and protection from the proverbial criminals, the terrorists, the cartels, what have you. Is there any truth to this dominant mainstream narrative?
No, I mean, certainly it's true that terrorists, if they can do their banking in cash, can buy arms and so forth and not have traceable transactions. I'm sure that they could do their business in gold coins if they needed to. What this is about, negative interest rates, is it is about a government policy of intentionally punishing the most responsible members of society, the savers and investors, in order to bail out the least responsible members of society and to encourage their continuing reckless behavior of borrowing and spending beyond their means. Because if they can borrow and spend beyond their means, in the short run, that supports the economy. Now, of course, it fundamentally undermines the long-term prospects for the economy if we're teaching people not to invest and save for the future and instead to spend all of their money in the immediate present tense. But that's what they're trying to do. And in order to do it, they've got to get rid of cash in order to make possible negative interest rates.
Well, speaking of cash and currencies, we just heard you and Dr. Fauber touch on hedge fund manager Kyle Bass's highly publicized and outsized bet against the Chinese yuan. Now, Dr. Fauber seemed to hint that Mr. Bass should tread carefully and not underestimate the People's Bank of China and their commitment to proving hedge fund managers like him wrong when it comes to betting against them. Now, Kyle Bass has gotten plenty of flack over the years and has even been accused of being a one-trick pony, referring to his wildly successful subprime mortgage trade. But just today, Bass was again proven right when the Texas-based REIT UDF was raided by the FBI. What do you think Kyle Bass's chances are in his battle against the Chinese central bankers and their currency?
Well, first of all, since you mentioned Kyle Bass, I just want to reassure our listeners. We heard you loud and clear in the listener forums about how much you want Kyle Bass interviewed on the show. We want that, too. Mr. Bass is a little bit harder to get than some of the other interviewers that you have heard on the program and elsewhere. If anyone in our audience knows Mr. Bass and has his ear, please tell him Macro Voices is worth his time. Meanwhile, we will continue to do everything that we can to hit his radar screen and get you an interview with Mr. Bass coming up sometime in the future. Until we do that, though, I think what Mark Fauber said was spot on, which is the PBOC does not like what Mr. Bass has had to say about their currency. They're going to do everything that they possibly can to discredit him, punish him, hurt him, whatever. The question is, in the long run, are the fundamentals so strong, as Kyle Bass says they are, that the PBOC will ultimately fail and he will win and he will be proven right, even if he had to endure some volatility along the way, and make a fortune by betting on a dramatic further devaluation of the Chinese currency. You know, he certainly did nail the subprime thing. Everybody laughed at him then. I'm not about to laugh at him now. I would say that Mark Fauber is right, that the PBOC is going to create as many obstacles as they can figure out how to make. It is a battle between these guys, and ultimately, economic fundamentals will win. But there can be a lot of scars along the way on a battle like this.
And as always, we can expect to see absolutely no ego influencing how this all plays out.
No, especially not here on this show.
So I want to move on now. Let's give our listeners, Eric, an update on an idea that we discussed last week for our show with energy consultant Art Berman. We have him booked for February 26. Now, we asked you last week whether you'd rather have Eric do a traditional interview with Art or us do an alternative scenario where we're recording a conversation between a hedge fund manager and his industry consultant so that we could all listen in on that conversation. You, our listeners, responded overwhelmingly that you'd much rather just listen in.
Yes, and my attorney responded as well, so I need to clarify what we can actually do on the air. I am not at liberty to make representations about the hedge fund that I manage or the positions that it contains. So for regulatory compliance reasons, I cannot represent the fund that I manage in a on-the-air interview with Art. What I can do is basically to role play the role of a hypothetical institutional investor who sees a bottom coming in the crude oil market, which I very definitely see, and is evaluating different ways to play it. And this format will actually work better because instead of just representing the types of instruments that my fund is able to trade, I'll be able to play this role of coming at this from a fixed income guy's perspective, looking at the junk bond trades, coming at it from a commodity futures trader's perspective, coming at it from an equity trader's perspective, looking at all of the different angles of how it might make sense to express an investment view that the crude oil market is about to bottom and will have a very substantial upside in the next several years.
So we also got some good suggestions and discussion about the actual format of such an interview. So let's tell everyone our latest thinking on that, Eric.
Well, we've considered several possible formats, and I'm just going to be honest and say we haven't figured it out yet. Art and I could just stop and explain the background of what we're talking about so it makes sense to listeners. We also considered a format where Art and I might just dive in and go deep on the terminology. Then we would edit the interview after the fact. So you'd hear Nathan's voice interjecting explanations in between exchanges between me and Art explaining what the technical jargon means and so forth. At this point, I think we've decided that wouldn't be practical. We're still in our infancy for this podcast project, and just the editing challenge of that scenario is a little bit more than we can bite off right now. So we're going to take some kind of approach of me role-playing the part of a speculative institutional investor, trying to look at all of the different angles of how to play the coming bottom in oil prices. Art will provide the industry perspective, and we'll figure out somehow how to explain it so that it is something that everybody can follow.
Bottom line, folks, we're still brainstorming on this end about the best way to present this, but I think either way, it promises to be an excellent show. Eric, before we close, I want to express our thanks publicly to Grant Williams of Real Vision Television and the wildly popular Things That Make You Go, blog. Grant went out of his way to tell his subscribers about our new podcast when we launched last week, and we really appreciated the gesture. It means a lot. Thank you, Grant.
Yeah, Grant is a super guy. We really appreciate his support, and I can't say enough for how much we need everyone's support. So listeners, please tell all your friends about Macro Voices, post a link to it on social media, do whatever you can do to get the word out. We really need your help.
And before you guys ask, yes, of course we know that you want to see Grant Williams on the show, as do we. So we've already booked him for April. We've got that base covered. I'm also working on some of the other excellent suggestions posted on the listener discussion forums at www.macrovoices.com/forums. So we're working on Martin Armstrong. He's been a very common request from our listeners. And there's several other names. We're doing what we can to recruit everybody that you guys have suggested that we get on the show. And Eric, before we close, I want to address a couple questions that came up from your interview with Jim Rogers on last week's show. You and Jim both said you're short junk bonds in the U.S., and we had some of the forum users who were inquiring as to how exactly a mere mortal like us would go about shorting the junk bond market in the U.S. Can you help us out with that?
Sure. It's actually gotten a heck of a lot easier than it used to be. In the old days, if you wanted to be short junk bonds, you'd have to pick a list of individual issues and then actually short them as individual trades. These days, there's an ETF for everything. So the two most popular junk bond ETFs are JNK, that's Juliet November Kilo, and HYG, Hotel Yankee Golf. Both of those are long junk bond funds, so if your view, as mine and Jim Rogers, is that junk bonds are in trouble and likely to trade higher in yield, lower in price, you would want to be short those ETFs. Selling short is something that you need a margin account for. Not everybody is comfortable being short. So there is another option, which is another ETF, is an inverse junk bond ETF. That's Sierra Juliet Bravo, SJB. That's a case of you buy it, hold it as a long position, and it benefits when the price of junk bonds goes down.
Can we also share our plans for our listener discussion forums with the listeners before we close?
Sure. You know, this is something that I really hope that we'll find a groundswell of support from our listeners for. I have felt for a long time like there's really no good place to go on the internet for an online discussion forum for grown-ups to talk about finance and investing topics. I would love to create a network of private investors, high net worth individuals, family offices, sophisticated investors that all share investing ideas in a polite, grown-up, adult discussion forum. And you know, you look at the stuff, Nathan, that's on the internet. You look at something like Zero Hedge is a very popular investing site. If you've ever looked at the comment threads on Zero Hedge posts, I don't think any of these people have graduated from junior high school yet. It is just so sophomoric and name-calling and so forth. It's no wonder that there's very little substantive content in terms of discussion there. So I have a vision of creating a free online discussion forum. In order for this to work, we would have to recruit a small army of volunteer moderators to help us keep the name-calling and the childishness that has destroyed so many other investing forums on the network out. But I think it would be really great to create an online community for private investors, sophisticated investors, to network with one another, communicate with one another, and so forth. So that's kind of my vision for what I would like to see our forums eventually become. Whether or not we get there is entirely up to the listeners. Can we get that critical mass of participation? We're going to do everything everything we can to make the forums a place that feel like it's for grown-ups, where we have adult conversation, where there's no name-calling, and we don't tolerate the sophomoric behavior that you see on other websites. You've got to do the rest, listeners. You've got to come show up and participate and create that interesting conversation that creates the critical mass that we need to attract more people. And I think we'll have something really exciting. At least that's what we're going to strive for.
Right. That's the goal for the forums. And that's the show for this week. On a closing note, just have to emphasize we're going to continue to need your help, listeners. Please subscribe, rate, and review us on iTunes. Tell everyone you know about Macro Voices or anyone who cares to listen. You can also follow us on Twitter if you'd like, at Macro Voices. And above all, be sure to tune in next week for our show with Art Berman. We've worked very hard on this. We will have the concept together by the time we go to record. And in the meantime, we'll see you all in the forums. Take care, everybody.
See you next week, guys.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week, free of charge. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend and Nathan Egger, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit macrovoices.com.